Here's to the innovators, the makers, the doers, and the hustlers. With Facebook Elevate, you can grow your business, build your online presence, kickstart your career, or turn your passion of creating content into a reality. Facebook Elevate is a program that provides free digital marketing courses and one-on-one coaching from experts that can help you grow your business. Click the banner to start now. Facebook Elevate. On the rise together.
Welcome to the Old Time Boxing Show on the Grueling Truth Sports Network. The Old Time Boxing Show is brought to you by the Retired Boxers Foundation and MyBookie.ag. I'm your host for the Old Time Boxing Show, Mike Goodpaster. And right now, I want to welcome in the Grueling Truth resident boxing historian, Christopher Shelton. How you doing, Chris?
Good. Nice to talk to you, Mike.
Do you have a good Christmas?
I got to out in San Diego with the family and such, so it was nice getting out of Phoenix for a little while. Better weather.
I bet it's warmer in San Diego than it is in Indiana right now.
That's probably true. It's actually, we're having a warm season. We're probably warm in general over Indiana.
It's 8 right now here.
Yikes, it's probably about 75 right now here.
I hate you. Metaphorically, I hate you. All right.
Thank you.
So our show today, and I want to thank everybody for that's been listening to the Old Time Boxing Show. The numbers have been really good lately. Our show today is about Jerry Quarry. Jerry Quarry was, I think, one of the greatest heavyweights to not win a part of the heavyweight title. What are your recollections of Jerry Quarry and his career, Christopher?
Well, I would say, you know, again, we've had to do this a couple of times, the Great White Hope thing. Very popular fighter. I can remember as a kid watching I Dream of Jeannie, and he had an episode that was featured around him. Even though he got beat up by Major Nelson and Jeannie, that's still a pretty high-profile gig. So I mostly just remember him as being famous, a guy who fought famous guys and lost to those famous guys.
Well, I think Jeannie in real life was a dominatrix, so I think she already was a little bit tougher than what everybody thought she would be. I also remember him being in one of my favorite shows when I was younger, Adam 12. I know he had a reoccurring role there.
Well, as I said, I know that I never saw it, but he did a Knight Rider episode that I think featured him late, you know, after his career. But, he was just a really high-profile guy, a very popular guy. I guess he probably had about a 4 or 5 run where he was certainly the most popular white heavyweight, if not the most popular, well-liked heavyweight for those 4 or 5 years in general.
And see, I think the most important thing about this is it has nothing to do with white heavyweight. He was a hell of a fighter. He's one of the best counterpunching heavyweights of all time. It just happened, like, we interviewed guys like Ernie Shavers, George Foreman, guys like that. And the heavyweight division from, the mid-60s to probably the late 1970s was probably at the peak with more really good to great fighters than has ever existed in that division's history.
Yeah, it was a great run, and you're right. It's not Quarry's fault, whatever his background is, racially or ethnicity. And also, he was Irish, and Irish have always been very supportive of anyone they believe of American Irish or Irish blood. So he had a very strong cult following, so he had that following, along with him.
Yeah, and I mean, let's face it, boxing is tribal. It doesn't mean it's racist that you like Jerry Quarry and he's white, just like it's not racist that a black man might like Muhammad Ali, because I liked Muhammad Ali too. You got Floyd Mayweather, it doesn't make you racist if you're black and you like Floyd Mayweather. I think people need to get over that because people self-identify with people that look like them.
Yeah, I agree. I agree that I mean, I have great respect for Floyd Mayweather, the boxer. I'm not always rooting for him and stuff like that. And I agree, you know, you have two people in the ring, and if one happens to be white, one happens to be black. Corey just stood out because of that particular time, there weren't that many great heavyweights. You know, Chavala was in that period and such. And I'm really grateful for the Klitschko brothers. My friend Dennis Taylor doesn't like them so much. He thinks they're boring. But I'm just glad they got rid of that finally. Now we can just concentrate on heavyweight boxers and not worry about, you know, their what color they are.
Oh, you still worry about that, though, because right now the greatest thing that could happen at a heavyweight division would be for a Jerry Cooney or a Jerry Quarry or any of those guys to show up right now, because it put butts in seats. And, you know, we just had Deontay Wilder bring up the fact that he doesn't get enough media attention because he's black. So I think it kind of goes both ways. And I really think that Wilder didn't get much attention because there's no depth at a heavyweight division. So watching him beat up a bloated, overweight, out of shape Berman Stiverne or any of the other numerous guys he's beaten, I think that's the main reason he doesn't get much attention. If he beats Anthony Joshua, he'll get the attention he wants.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it is really hard to tell because I don't know if it's necessarily just a racial component. In that particular time with Corey and Ollie and all of them, the heavyweights are really the kings. And then somewhere in the late 70s to 80s, the non-heavyweights started taking over. And then in these days, even though they're two completely different sports and they have nothing to do with each other, UFC is constantly being compared against boxing. And its popularity is somehow allegedly eclipsing boxing, even though I have no idea why. Football has as much to do with boxing as UFC. But there's a lot of factors. And then there's the it factor. Whether you like Mike Tyson or not, whether you like Joe Louis or not, they were black and they were extraordinarily popular. Sometimes a boxer has the it factor, or they have the it fight.
Yeah, and Jerry Quarry had that. And Quarry,
he did.
First put on a pair of boxing gloves when he was 3 years old. By the time he was eight, he'd won a junior gold gloves championship at 45 pounds. He continued in the amateurs until 1964 when he culminated a great amateur career by winning a national golden gloves heavyweight title. I think his co-managers at the time were his dad and veteran fight manager Johnny Flores. He turned pro in May of 1965, ran off like 12 wins against kind of nondescript competition the way everybody does early in their career. Tony Doyle held him to a draw. He also had two draws with Tony Olangi, who was not a bad fighter, but his first loss came in his 20th pro bout against Eddie Macon. Eddie Macon was a guy that was a very good fighter also, and just from reading what Quarry said in the Ring magazine after that fight, I mean, he admitted he lost. He said it was a good lesson. And he said that now it kind of takes the pressure off of him because he's lost a fight. Now he can start learning. So the first loss to Eddie was not necessarily a bad thing to happen to him.
No, I think in all sports, actually, I think boxing, there's too much pressure these days that a boxer go into a fight undefeated. And in the NFL, in its long history, only one team went through the whole process undefeated. Only one heavyweight champion, you know, Mark Rocky Marciano, finished undefeated. I think the best teams maybe ever, or the best boxers ever, are those who lose, and they learn something from that loss, and they become better boxers or better teams.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because the thing that gets me, like with Floyd Mayweather, I mean, I saw him lose to Jose Luis Castillo. All right, I saw that with my own two eyes. But to me, I think a loss will kind of ground you and maybe teach you, maybe you learn from that. Where the other thing is this, I think it's really hard to be considered great unless you're challenged. You know, nobody says Joe Montana won, what, four Super Bowls?
Yeah, four Super Bowls.
While doing that, it took a 92-yard drive in the last 3 minutes and 22 seconds to beat the Bengals. When you look at Troy Aikman.
Let me get to my point.
This is my point. Troy Aikman won three Super Bowls. Everybody considers him overrated because they won all three of them easily.
Right. I was just going to say with even the Joe Montana, he threw that, you know, interception in the end zone, the Cincinnati guy dropped. So there's also in the famous football game Pittsburgh and New England, it wouldn't have happened if Brady almost threw an interception that Pittsburgh dropped. There's also being great, and then there's a couple breaks going your way. And some of those guys in sports, it goes your way sometimes. And I think sometimes with boxing, sometimes it's just not your night, and sometimes it's not your night, but you dig from deep within and make it your night. There's a lot of complications with how a person gets through something undefeated.
All right, so next up, probably the next big name on there was Jerry Quarry, beat Brian London at the old Olympic Auditorium, where Quarry fought a lot of his fights. London was very awkward, actually went the distance with Quarry, and the interesting thing is here, Brian London, after the fight, was quoted as saying, "Jerry is a nice boy, but he will never be a world-class fighter. If he was a world-class fighter, he would have destroyed me." He said, 7 years ago, I would have destroyed him. I don't know about you, but I've seen a lot of Brian London film against Floyd Patterson and him, and Brian London would have never beat Jerry Quarry.
Well, I look at Brian London, and I don't want to, you know, disrespect any of our English listeners, but I look at him as an American punching bag. He sort of wins and does all these things in England, and then he comes to America and gets beat up by our fighters. Charming guy. You know, I've actually, you know, read some of the things he said. He's a sort of a rogue and a funny guy, but I think he's an American punching bag.
Yeah, and then the next fight that really stood out to me was at the Memorial Coliseum in L.A., where Floyd Patterson drew with Jerry Quarry. And from watching this fight again, I thought Quarry won the fight.
It's really tough because to watch them fight, and we'll get to the other fight they have, because Patterson's really pressing it, but he's not really doing a lot of damage, and Quarry is countering him, and it's a tough thing because it's really tough watching the two fights he has with Patterson and judging them. They're both pretty close. Quarry seems to land the harder punches and the knockdown punches, but Patterson's definitely pressing these fights.
Yeah, I don't think the fight was by any means a robbery. I think it was close. I think I had it like 5-4-1. But I did think Quarry kind of snuck it out. And the one thing I noticed about Quarry during his career is he had a tendency to be really good in the first half of the fight and then kind of peter off after the fifth or sixth round.
Yeah, that was certainly his reputation, and it's hard to say whether he was just expending so much energy in the early going, or the other boxers were being patient and letting him wear himself out, or whether he just wasn't quite preparing for or pacing himself properly. But I would say that he definitely seemed to do his best in the earlier rounds.
Yeah, and then next up you had, of course, Muhammad Ali retires, or doesn't retire, forced to retire, goes into exile for 3 years. And they start a heavyweight tournament with 8 boxers in it, not including Joe Frazier, who decided to go ahead and take the New York State Heavyweight Championship, which was recognized by a lot of people as being legit. But you had the WBA sanction the title. You had, I think the 8 fighters were Jimmy Ellis, Leotis Martin, Oscar Bonavina, Carl Mildenberger, Jerry Quarry, of course, Floyd Patterson, Ernie Terrell, Thad Spencer. In the first round of this tournament, you had to rematch October 28th at the Olympic Auditorium between Quarry and Patterson. Quarry wins a majority decision. The fight for me, though, I thought Quarry won the first fight, but I thought Patterson won the second fight.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, it is such a close second fight, and the fans certainly agreed with you because it's in Quarry's turf, and they were rooting for him going into the fight. And then by the end of the fight, when they made the decision, which was a draw on one card and a 7-6 on the other two, the fans were hurling things in the ring. They were so mad. And I don't know. It is, again, like the first one, they're very close fights, and the judges ultimately ruled that those two knockdowns, Quarry scored 2 knockdowns, Patterson scored none, that those were the difference. If there had been no knockdowns, Patterson would have won. If there had been 1 knockdown by Quarry, it would have been a draw. But Quarry had 2 knockdowns over 0, and he squeaked out on 2 judges' cards a 1-point victory.
Yeah, then in the semifinals of the tournament, he fights Thad Spencer. I guess a bad Thad, just Spencer. But he fights Thad Spencer. Spencer actually entered the ring as a 7-5 favorite. A lot of people thought this guy might be the next guy to be
right. The number one ranked heavyweight at that time, though it's kind of absurd when you have Frazier and Ali not even being counted in the equation, but the number one ranked heavyweight fought Ernie Terrell and defeated him in the first round. It's almost shocking to believe that Thad Spencer would never win a professional fight again after that bout over Ernie Terrell, and it's one of Quarry's best fights. Quarry, you know, really batters him about. Thad Spencer also went in there trying to pretend he was Muhammad Ali, and you are not Muhammad Ali. And Quarry is one of the best. Quarry battered him around, knocked him down in the tens, completely dominated him. One of Quarry's best fights.
Yeah, and he ends up knocking him out at 257th of the 12th round, and that takes him to the finals, where he gets what most people consider, I don't, of course, because the heavyweight champion at that time is Muhammad Ali. You know, so we don't need to have that argument again. But then he fights Jimmy Ellis for the vacant WBA World Heavyweight title. And, of course, as every fight that Corey fought in, it was a majority decision. What was your take? I know you probably watched this fight again. And
right.
What was your take on the decision?
I thought even Ellis was more dominant. I didn't really think it was very close. I was so frustrated with Corey during that fight because Ellis is boxing and he's, you know, kind of bouncing around on his feet, landing jabs and really not landing any hard punches, but just completely outboxing Corey. And Corey finally toward the end, even though his reputation was as somebody who died at the end, he finally sort of gets going and actually staggers and doesn't knock him down, but he staggers Ellis in the 13th. And you could see, gosh, if he presses this fight against Ellis, that's where he's most effective. And at that moment, his corner yelling at him, fight him, fight him, fight him. But because he was doing this counter-punching strategy, he was really just boxing and doing nothing while Ellis was just bouncing around. And it's one of those frustrating things because Corey would have been considered champion if he had won, but he didn't win. And he didn't win because he didn't press the fight when clearly that was where he was most effective against Ellis.
Yeah, but the one thing I did notice was an article from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, August 8, 1968, that reported that Corey broke his back several weeks before the Ellis fight, and the injury had occurred during a friendly wrestling match with one of his brothers. The extent of the injury wasn't known until Corey had x-rays taken on August the 6th. But I don't want to take away from Ellis here because I think that this fight was basically, it was a tactical masterpiece by Ellis, and I don't want to take anything away from him.
He was a real smart boxer, and that was the right opponent for him. And whatever was going on with Corey, Ellis dictated everything. I mean, and Corey liked to counter, and Ellis really didn't give him anything to counter. You really had to fight your own fight and not fight Ellis's fight. And I don't know if that, you know, made Ellis the champion. And meanwhile, you got an undefeated Joe Frazier, champion in five states. And then you have an undefeated Muhammad Ali, who they're not allowing to fight. So you have three big names, but Jerry Corey still also came out as sort of a star, at least a high-profile guy.
Yeah, then Corey gets back on the horse, beats a bunch of nondescript competition until we get to March 24th of 1969. Jerry Corey fought Buster Mathis, who was supposed to be, in 64, the Olympic representative for the United States at the heavyweight division, but he got injured. Joe Frazier took over for him from there. And, of course, the rest is history with Frazier. But Corey comes into the fight against Mathis as a pretty good underdog, and he dominated Mathis. I mean, I think this is one of Corey's better performances, too, where I think the judges, all of them had it either 9-2 or 11-1. He wins the fight easy to put himself back in play to get a shot at the heavyweight title.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big, strong guy. No chumps for sure. And Corey, you know, he's not hype. He does have some great fights. He just when it came to the biggest high profile fights, he seemed to not be in his game. But on the fights sort of leading to the big fights, he did very well. His fight against Thad Spencer is very impressive. He at least hung in there with Floyd Patterson. And yeah, he did a great job against Buster Mathis, whose kid also became a boxer.
Yeah, and then comes the one time I disagree with you, because I think 1969 for the New York State Athletic Commission World Heavyweight title against Joe Frazier, I think Jerry Corey was on top of his game. I think Joe Frazier was just a little bit better. But when you watch that fight, to me it's one of the forgotten great heavyweight title fights of all time. If you want to sit there and tell me Joshua Klitschko was this great fight, I'll tell you you're full of shit. Because if you go watch Joe Frazier against Jerry Corey or any other number of fights out there, Frazier-Corey won, especially the first couple rounds, looked like Hagler-Hearns.
Well, yeah, it was definitely viewed as the fight of the year. And that's it. The first couple of rounds are great. The first round, Corey won, and it's a slugfest. And the second round is a slugfest. Really, almost every round's a slugfest. But by the third round, Frazier is starting to dominate more and more. And I also think that one reason for its popularity is that Muhammad Ali, as exciting as he was, as brilliant as he was, he didn't like to engage in slugfests. And I think there's still something very special about boxing, the heavyweight division, when you got two big guys throwing punches punches. And that hadn't happened in a long time, maybe not at all in the 1960s, if I think about it, because you had Liston kind of dominating Patterson before Ali. And so people kind of just wanted two big guys throwing punches, and Corey was willing to do that. And great two rounds, and really a great third, fourth round. It's just Frazier started to dominate. And yeah, I agree with what you're saying, that I'm not sure Corey had a letdown. I think he was just facing a better boxer, a better fighter, and not too many people were going to beat Joe Frazier at that moment in his career in the history of boxing.
Yeah, and I think that when you look at Corey, Frazier and Ali were two of the greatest that ever lived, so I don't really take anything away there. The Jimmy Ellis fight, he should have won. I know we've got the broken back thing, but
I just think Jimmy Ellis, I think Jimmy Ellis outclassed him out, you know. Maybe Corey had problems and stuff, but whatever it is, I think Ellis dominated that fight. And I do like to give him his due. You know, Ellis is another guy who we're probably never going to do a show about because we don't think people want to listen to it. But it's he was a great boxer. It's just, you know, he's also under the gun of Ali and Frazier. He wasn't them, but he was darn good.
All right. Then next up, we get Jerry Quarry against George Chavallo, which if you know anything about either one of them, you know this is going to be a hell of a fight. Quarry actually loses to Chavallo, gets stopped in the seventh round, and I think George Chavallo is a guy that also gets a little bit of an unfair rap if you look at his fight of the year in, what, 64, 65 against Patterson?
Yeah.
I mean, Chavallo was another one, goes the distance, what, twice with Ali over 27 rounds. I think these are two guys that both of them do not get their just due. They're both kind of just, well, they had the right pigmentation, so they got shots. But this was a hell of a fight, and George Chavallo came out on top of Quarry there, and I think people there had to start to question a little bit whether Jerry Quarry was already maybe going down on the wrong side of the hill.
Well, it was a great fight. I really enjoyed it. It was interesting to see. Chavallo, I guess the problem with Chavallo, the first strength is he never got knocked down, so he was a tough guy no matter who he faced. He just took a lot of losses, you know, to go along with his wins. So I guess that's the only reason. Otherwise, you might say, you know, who's the great best white heavyweight? Well, Chavallo beat Corey and knocked him out. It would be Chavallo, but he took a lot of losses, a lot more than Corey did. It was a great fight because Chavallo, who usually just sort of went in there like a robot, you know, throwing punches and being tough guy, stuff like that, used more of a jab. He boxed a little more than usual, and Corey landed some hard punches to Chavallo, and Chavallo landed hard punches to him. Both were showing a little bit of boxing, you know, talent. Corey always showed, you know, more boxing skills than Chavallo, but it's a hell of a fight. And then neither one had been knocked down going into the fight, and then Chavallo knocked Corey down, and it was a little confusing because there's a mandatory 8 count, so Corey goes down, and then he gets up, and then on the count of 2 to 3, he gets on his knees, even though it's a mandatory 8 count. Why don't you just stay on your feet? So he stayed on his knees until the referee counted 10, waved his hands over, and then Corey popped up, you know, ready to go. But unfortunately, you know, you've already been knocked out. So the referee said, you know, he just thinks that Chavallo punch was harder than you think. It was a left to the chin, and that Corey was stunned and a little confused. And I guess when George Chavallo hits you, I guess that would confuse me too. So great fight, though. A hell of a performance by both fighters.
Yeah, and like I said, people start to question whether maybe Quarry's going on the wrong side of the hill. Up comes Mac Foster, who's a man who was 24-0. I think all 24 fights by way of knockout. Quarry had dropped to 35-5-4 at the time. They fought at Madison Square Garden June 6, 1970. And this was a huge fight for Quarry to be able to get back in the mix. And after a bad start, Quarry breaks Foster down in round 5 with heavy left hooks to the body. And it was some cute defensive moves that I think are really underrated when you talk about Quarry that feature some great head feints. Jerry exploded into a savage flurry of crunching shots that put Mac into a heap in his own corner. The crowd goes wild because this was probably the best we've seen Jerry Quarry. And he gets back on the map.
Yeah, you know, then we're going to be dealing with a couple other ones where Corey. Corey's had some great fights, and he can box, and he can slug it out. He's a tough guy. I guess you do have to just say he's just one of the great guys who never became champion. He disappoints in some of his high-profile bouts, but these are also Mac Foster, Buster Mathis, And those were also lower high-profile fights, but he does Thad Spencer. Those are he fought extraordinarily well in some of these fights. Just it was a, you're right. He put himself. He was already at this point really, really famous and done I Dream of Jeannie and all that sort of stuff. You know, a national name. But yeah, he put himself in line, I suppose, for possibly another title defense.
Yeah, and he gets the biggest payday of his career, not a title defense. Of course, Muhammad Ali had not fought in 3 years since he knocked out Zora Foley in seven rounds in March of 1967. With the help of the Georgia State Senator Leroy Johnson, Ali was able to get a boxing license in Georgia on September 2nd, 1970. He boxed an eight-round exhibition, I believe it was at Morehouse College in Atlanta. The fight between Ali and Aquari was arranged for the end of October at the City Auditorium in Atlanta. And this was a fight where we get a headbutt early on. Aquari gets cut, never really gets a chance to have a shot in a fight just because of the cut.
Well, I think it was a good stoppage. I think Ali, you know, helped. Once Ali had cut Aquari, he just jabbed and jabbed into that eye. And the referee was smart. It was not, it's, the Ali fights, which we'll get into the second one, they sort of disgusted me a little bit, but not the first one. And also Ali, you know, the commentators are still calling him Clay, which is so disrespectful. I guess you can understand when he first changed his name that maybe the sports world was a little confused, but this is several years now, and at this point you're simply insulting the man who's quite frankly bringing energy and everything back to boxing. Joe Frazier is a champion, but everyone wants to see him fight Muhammad Ali and see who's the real champion when they battle out. And Muhammad Ali dominated one-sided, and Jerry Aquari picked up, I think, 340,000, the biggest purse of his career. So it's hugely high profile going in. Must be very disappointing that it was such a short fight, but I thought the referee had to stop it because Ali is all business at that point, and just left jab after left jab after left jab because he still wants to show people, look, I'm undefeated, I'm the real heavyweight champion, not Joe Frazier.
Yeah, and then next up, Aquari goes all the way to Wembley, London. This is for the British boxing fans. We're going to talk a little Jack Bodell. And the only reason I'm talking it is it was a devastating knockout. But going into this fight, Bodell had won 17 of his last 18. And he appeared like maybe he was going to be something. He'd won a 15-round decision over future contender Joe Buckner. But this is a fight where Quarry's counterpunching was at its best. Because Bodell comes out swinging wildly. Aquari just counterpunches him, cracks him once on the jaw, and the fight's pretty much over.
Yeah, you know, also, as much as, you know, Aquari was identified with being Irish and stuff, really, Aquari's an American, and that's the only reason why he in some ways, as high profile he is, he was just the American fighters were superior. This was the British champion, and they're dubbing it, who's the best white heavyweight between these two, and if that was the case, boy, this wasn't even close. Aquari just battered him around, knocked him out, like just barely over a minute, and proving it again, this is one of the dominant five fighters of his time. It's just a couple of those guys. It's like being a great, it's like being the Philadelphia Athletics in 1927, but you got the Murderers Row Yankees at the same time. Jerry Aquari was great at a time. He certainly battered around England's best heavyweight like it was nothing. He just happened to be an American with a couple Americans that were the high profile stars of the entire century.
Yeah, and then next, June 27th, 1972, we got a card that was publicized as the Soul Brothers versus the Aquari Brothers. And I think the reason this needs to be up is I think this had to affect Jerry Aquari, that his younger brother Mike challenging the great Bob Foster for the light heavyweight championship of the world, and he got hit with a shot that when you watch it even to this day, you wonder how it didn't kill his brother. And then he's got to come out and fight Muhammad Ali after that.
Yeah, I guess we'll probably get into the Aquari brothers and their dad, which reminds me a lot of the Benitez father with his kids. He had those kids fighting too young. They're fighting too hard in training. And then they were not only taking punches in the ring, which is what we get to see, but apparently they were taking a lot of punches in training. And I really am not into the whole promotion of that thing. I mean, I know Ali's doing what he has to do. This is going to be the end of the Great White Hopes, and it's promotion and stuff like that. But the fight itself is, you know, humiliating, embarrassing how Ali treated Aquari. He just treated him like a play toy, like a cat treats a mouse. Corey retired after the fight, the way he came back, but it was a humiliating performance. Ali showed he could take him out at any moment, and he goofed around and goofed around, and then finally, you know, just as the seventh round began, he very quickly, you know, let the referee know. He threw a quick hard jab, you know, I'm going to hurt this guy if you don't stop this fight, and the referee immediately stopped the fight at that point. But Ali could have stopped this thing 2-3 rounds earlier, and at that point, maybe the referee should stop the fight. This looked like a pro versus an amateur, and I just have such great respect for Jerry Corey that I know Muhammad Ali does what he has to do. And I got really mad after I watched the fight again, which I know I told you, Mike, I'm so mad at Ali right now. But Ali's doing what he does. You know, he's doing what he has to do for promotion, and he's doing what he has to do in the ring to entertain the fans. And that meant just embarrassing and humiliating Jerry Corey, as if you think this guy seriously can compete against me. I'm not mad at Ali now, but he just it's embarrassing to watch that fight.
Yeah, and you talked about Jerry Corey's dad, but the story I read about his dad was he didn't train Corey again after the Frazier fight because he told Jerry that he should retire and go buy a service station or something.
I hope that's what he told him. I know that he
did. And then the other story that I read was that his dad, I guess, tried to kill himself, pulled the trigger with the gun in his mouth, but it had made an imprint on the bullet or the shell. But didn't fire out. But I don't know. It just seems
like
the whole family.
Well, I also gathered one thing, and even when you talked about the brother and them playfully wrestling and Corey's back getting seriously injured, this is a dysfunctional family. Corey alludes to it several times that it was a sort of a weird background and such like that. But they were encouraged to be fighters, and yeah, if Corey had maybe just stopped then after the Ali fight, maybe things would have turned out better. But I think his reputation would have took a pounding, because somehow when he came out of retirement, he really had his best run as a heavyweight.
Well, then we get to what I think is his best year, 1973. Jerry Corey fights Ron Lyle, who was 19-0 with 17 knockouts. He was the sensation in a heavyweight division. And, I mean, Corey, if you watch that fight, completely dominated the fight. I think Waldemar Schmidt had it the closest at 7-4. But Tony Castellano scored the fight 10-2. Bill Rex scored the fight 9-1. And to me, this fight and the fight against Shavers we're going to talk about after this, this is the best Corey ever looked.
Yeah, absolutely. And we were talking earlier about the couple of the other, you know, Mac Foster and Lester Mathis and Thad Spencer, to throw those names back out again. But this is the sharpest he ever looked. Ron Lyle's a tough guy, and Corey outboxed him. Corey outslugged him. I'm kind of glad. I was sort of worried when we did Jerry Corey. I thought, oh, Mike, I feel like I'm going to go on the air and just say bad things about Jerry Corey. Everybody's going to hate me. But I'm glad we're going over these fights, because that was another great performance by Corey. Corey did have some really great performances in him. And yeah, the Lyle one is just, he completely outclasses and outboxes and outslugs this guy. It's a hell of a fight for Corey.
Yeah, and then next up, he fights Ernie Shavers, who I think is maybe the greatest puncher in heavyweight boxing history. Shavers comes into the fight. And the thing that's great is if you watch the YouTube video, especially on my channel, there's like an 18-minute prelude there where you see Joe Frazier, Muhammad Ali, Floyd Patterson, Jack Dempsey, Joe Lewis, all these guys coming to the ring. I mean, this was a huge fight, and Corey comes out and just destroys Shavers in like 2 minutes and 21 seconds of the first round, and now it looks like Corey's really got it going. And I got the pleasure to interview Ernie Shavers last week. And I mean, Ernie Alvarez said that Corey hit him as hard as anybody ever hit him. And he said the thing that stood out to him was he hit Corey with a right hand that he said knocked everybody he ever fought down except for Corey. Now, the other one I'll tell you is this. We had George Foreman on the show, and Foreman off air also said that Jerry Corey, because of his counterpunching ability and how tough he was the only guy that he definitely decided he was going to avoid as a heavyweight champion.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. I'm been wandering around, so I haven't been able to hear all your great interviews. But yeah, I always wondered what would happen with Corey and Foreman and how they didn't meet up. So it's nice to hear Foreman said, and Foreman was always very, you know, modest and said, "Hey, I was scared a little bit when I fought Frazier and Norton." I think when you're a tough guy, you can admit stuff like that. But yeah, Corey treated Shavers like he was Jack O'Dell. Just went in there and destroyed Ernie Shavers. Again, extraordinary run after he retired versus Ali. And you know, it's fantastic for his legacy because you can look back and pick these fights and say, wow, Jerry Corey, if it just had worked out this way or that way, he would have been champion. And it was an amazing performance. And I'm glad to hear Ernie Shavers again so articulate and modest, too, about his own boxing.
Now, after this fight, everything looks really good for Corey. But we go to 1974, and it's like 6 months later. And to me, when I'm watching these old films, this is where I see the degeneration start. You look at him. He comes out to fight a guy by the name of Joe Alexander, who was 8-3. And he wins the fight on the second round knockout. He gets knocked down once, I think, towards the end of the first round by Alexander. But in this fight, Corey really started to show signs of sluggishness. And, I mean, he looked a little bloated.
Well, it was supposed to be sort of a tune-up fight, and you know, to face Frazier again. And I guess you're right. Maybe I think it was sort of an exciting two-round bout because Alexander, you know, did land a hard punch and stuff.
Yeah, but this is the thing. When I watch this fight, this is the one fight where I don't see Corey as a counterpuncher. I don't see him with any head movement. He looks like he's out of shape, and his motor skills just don't look like what they were, because I think if they were, I don't think there's no way in hell a Joe Alexander is going to put him on the ground.
Well, I may not have said it right, but I was agreeing with you that I thought it was an exciting fight. But now that I'm thinking about it and what you're saying, maybe it shouldn't have been an exciting fight. And maybe the fact that it was exciting when it shouldn't have been should have had more warning signs attached to it.
Yeah, and I think the warning signs only get worse from there. He wins the fight. He goes out. He fights Joe Frazier again. And, of course, it's a war. The first couple rounds, I mean, Corey hangs with him a little bit. And then it's kind of like the second fight, or like the first fight on steroids, only Frazier just starts to whip his ass even worse. And he gets badly cut. And the thing that really stood out to me watching this was you had Joe Louis, who had no business being a referee in a fight in 1974, took way too long to stop this fight.
Yeah, Joe, you know, sometimes they let these boxers, you know, referee, and they really shouldn't, unless that's really specifically what they're trained to do. Joe Louis does look a little confused out there, and Corey is taking a serious battering. The first round, I guess, is exciting again. You know, it's almost like the first round light. The first fight was so exciting for the first two rounds, maybe the first three or four rounds before Frazier dominates. But Frazier starts dominating earlier in this fight, and Corey is cut and getting battered around, and there really is no reason to keep it going, even as long as they did, which was only, what, five rounds.
Yeah. All right, real quick, we're going to take a quick station break, a little advertisement from mybookie.ag. We'll be back to talk about the end of the career. We got the Ken Norton fight, the Lorenzo Zenon fight, the two ill-fated comeback attempts. So we'll be back right after this.
Hey, everyone. My name is Alex Golden. I am the host of the Courtroom Podcast, an NBA debate show here at The Grueling Truth. And I'm here with one simple message. If you're watching the games, it's time to start making money. The Grueling Truth has partnered with MyBookie.ag, an industry-leading sportsbook website who reminds you that where you bet is just as important as who you're betting on. And that's why The Grueling Truth urges you to check out MyBookie.ag. In addition to the usual thousands of odds, money lines, proposition bets, and futures offered on MyBookie.ag daily, they also have in-game live betting and a mobile site that makes wagering on the go easier than ever. So join now, and MyBookie.ag will give you a 50% bonus on first deposit for up to $3,000 in extra playing money. Just enter promo code TGT50. That's TGT50 to take advantage of this offer. Visit MyBookie.ag, courtesy of the Grueling Truth Network, and enjoy winning today. mybookie.ag. You play, you win, you get paid.
All right, guys, we're back on the Old Time Boxing Show on the Grueling Truth Sports Network. I'm your host, Mike Goodpaster, with the resident Grueling Truth boxing historian, Christopher Shelton. We are talking today about the career of Jerry Quarry, and now we've moved on to, a lot of people thought Frazier should retire. He takes 7 or 8 months off, comes back, beats George Johnson, who's a guy with a losing record. Then he gets another payday against Ken Norton. Norton is in his prime here. This is, what, about a year, a year and a half before he fought Ali the third time.
Right. And he lost the heavyweight chance against George Foreman. He'd fought Ali, beat him once, lost once, broke his jaw, and before his third fight against Ali. So, yeah, really kind of at the peak of his career.
Yeah, and then you get Norton as a number four contender, fighting Quarry as a number five contender. Quarry had complained that top black heavyweights would not fight him, that it was a black conspiracy. You know, he said that he was being boycotted by Ali, Norton, and Foreman. He said they wanted to leave the little white boy out of it. Of course, unfortunately, Ali had already beat his ass twice.
And Frazier beat him up twice. So, yeah, I don't think Ali and Frazier are avoiding him. I think at this point they're not sure how much value is in a third fight at that point.
Well, there was no value for Ali. There was value for Norton because Norton needed a good win there to get another title shot against Ali. This is another fight similar to Frazier where Quarry gave it everything the way he always did, but Norton was just too strong for him. And I think when you look at Quarry and Norton, I think if this fight's in 1968 or 69, it's an absolute great fight. And I think who would win this fight would be completely up in the air to conjecture. But right here, Norton's in his prime. Quarry's definitely not. And this ends up being another one-sided beating.
It's a one-sided beating, and Norton's something else. You know, we're going to one day do a show about him, I'm sure. But his fighting style is so weird, and it's very hard to describe. He's not really backing, and he's not really even moving forward. He's mostly standing there and covering his face and letting Quarry sort of pound away, not really taking a lot of damage, and then just in the early couple rounds, and then just waiting and waiting to land an uppercut, which he would do, and stagger Quarry, and then go back to just sort of standing there and kind of letting himself getting hit without getting damaged. And then, by the third round, they're saying, hey, we have a war, and because there is hard punching, but mostly Norton is deflecting Quarry and then is occasionally landing hard punches. And then after the third round, Norton's dominating and landing more and more of the hard punches, and Quarry's clearly tiring and getting beat up and bleeding and such until the fifth round where, they ended it. These are brutal fights Quarry's getting into, and Norton, they're kind of slugfests, but they're slugfests with Frazier and Norton where clearly Quarry's taking the more serious beating.
Yeah, and then next up, he takes 2 years off. Like you said, he's in some TV. I mean, he's a very talented man. I mean, he was a good actor with the stuff he was in, from Adam 12 to Knight Rider to everything else. He was very popular. There's no reason he had to come back, but he missed the bright lights. The other thing I'd read was, a few years before that, he had started with the cocaine, the alcohol, all that. He comes by it to fight Lorenzo Zenon. Zenon was eventually European champion. He looked like a yo-yo in his heavyweight title defense against Larry Holmes, where he was bounced off the canvas repeatedly till the fight was stopped. Zenon probably had the worst jaw of any heavyweight championship competitor I've ever seen. And Zenon actually boxes the crap out of Quarry for 8 rounds. Quarry taps him on the jaw in the 9th round. Quarry wins the fight. But even Jerry Quarry was so unimpressed with his performance that he retires yet again.
Yeah, and as you said, one of the things that, we don't know exactly what happened to his fortune and stuff like that, but yeah, drugs somewhere along the line got mixed in, and that was going to, cause problems involving what money he had and what he had to do to try to make money. In retrospect, the Ernie Shaver's first round knockout is the peak of everything, and if he could go back in time, you just have him retire then. But he didn't. And at this point, every fight he's taking, he's risking the ability to dress himself, the ability to know who he is. These are hard to watch because of what's going to happen to Corey, and you just want him out of the ring and to stop fighting.
Yeah, and then he retires for 6 years. But during those years, he was still in fights because he got married twice, divorced twice, lost a great deal of his fortune in failed business investments. No longer doing TV work, as I know from watching some fights in the late 70s, mid-70s, you'd see him on there every once in a while. So he decided to return to the ring because the cruiserweight division had just been created. He returned in that weight class, and he was not in good health. I remember Sports Illustrated did an article on him in 1983, and he was then 37 years old. He was training for a comeback attempt. And though he appeared to be in good health, his performances on several simple cognitive tests were shockingly poor. The title of that Sports Illustrated article, April 11, 1983, is "Too Many Punches, Too Little Concern" by Robert Boyle. And he comes out, and he won two fights against Lupe Guerra, and then he beat a guy by the name of James Washington, who was 23-25-2. And then he retires again, and, I mean, this is just... We see this too much in boxing.
Yeah, I guess the Lupe Guerra type fight was, and Guerra also got batted around by Frank Bruno. It shows after not fighting for so many years. I mean, that was a big story in the New York Times, the L.A. Times. It proves, if nothing else, Corey is still a big name to the table. And at least with that fight, Guerra didn't even land a punch, and Corey knocked him down with his very first punch, and then landed three more punches and knocked him out in about 30 seconds. So at least Corey didn't get injured in that fight. But it's amazing that the New York Times and L.A. Times we're still giving it the sort of, is Corey going to come back, and stuff like that. When he said Sports Illustrated, he had taken cognitive skills that said he was facing already some sort of brain damage, and really he had no reason to come back. Faced James Williams and took more punches, even though he got the victory.
Yeah, then in 1992, after 9 years of inactivity at the age of 47, Jerry, I guess inspired by George Foreman's comeback, decided he was going to come back. And this is the saddest part of this whole freaking story, and it's the thing that pisses me off the most. And you talked about his family, which was dysfunctional. He had friends that were dysfunctional, and they made him think that there was going to be a movie written about him, a book written about him, and he was going to make this great comeback. And the thing that stands out to me is this. When watching the videos of him, like 1995, which was only 3 years after this, you watch the Hall of Fame induction video from the World Boxing Hall of Fame. He can't tie his shoes. He can't write his name. He can barely talk. The thing that really bothers me is I also found a video from 1992 where he's getting ready to make this comeback, and he was talking all right. I mean, and in this fight, you put him in against a guy by the name of Ron Kramer, who was 3-4-1 in Aurora, Colorado, and he took horrific punishment for 6 rounds. And the people that were supposed to be his friends and his family, they freaking sat there and watched him get his brain scrambled. I mean, it's one of the most pathetic things I've ever seen in my life. And the people that are taking care of him in the 95 video were there watching that fight.
He was surrounded by disgusting people, including his trainer at the time. It's hard to know whether it's just greed or delusions. It is very, very sad. And California, in a high-profile denial of giving Corey a license, their ruling also is that if anyone assists Corey in any way to fight in some other state, we're going to sanction punish you too. But nonetheless, he did get that fight. And what's so sad is at his peak with Muhammad Ali, he earned about $340,000. He only earned $1,000 to take this beating.
Yeah, and it's a beating that shouldn't have happened. And like I said, you see the stuff with his brother taking care of him in 1995. Where the hell was his brother in 1992?
Yeah, it's very sad. As I said, the reason I guess to think about the Benitez brothers is four sons, three boxers, all three of those brain damaged, and then the one that wasn't a boxer turned out fine. Corey, four brothers, three boxers, two with dementia, one with Parkinson's, and then the one that wasn't a boxer turned out just fine.
Yeah, except for the fact that he was an asshole, from what I saw.
Well, that might be. He might be an asshole. I don't think the Benitez, the one that wasn't a fighter, was an asshole, but that might be too. You know, but fighting is, you know, what we do, and we take it very serious, Mike, is we know we're dealing with a really rough sport, and we try to be fair about it, and we don't want to see the boxers hurt, but we understand that's part of what happens.
Yeah, and see, the thing is this, and I think that you cannot leave this out, is the fact that Jerry, Mike, Bob, especially Jerry and Mike, both had problems with alcohol and cocaine, and that does not help your brain either. So I don't think this is just a boxing thing, because I think there's too many people. We see all kind of boxers. Like, I interviewed Yaki Lopez last week. He was in multiple wars. He's completely fine. You get a Riddick Bowe, who was in two or three wars. But the thing about Riddick Bowe is he was not always in shape. You know, he didn't always take care of himself. He got into the drugs. He got into the alcohol. And I think all this contributes to it. So I think, yeah, boxing is a big culprit in this. But the way these guys take care of themselves has to be, you know, brought into account also.
Oh, yeah, and it's also – it's really tough to tell, you know, people when they're in their 20s and early 30s, you know, what's going to happen to you in your 50s and 60s, and that, you know, Evander Holyfield's probably taken as big a beating as anybody I can imagine, and yet at this point he's still okay, and you can't tell. I mean, James Harrison, the football player, who just left Pittsburgh for New England, that guy's taking a battering. I mean, a real serious battering. I would say, hey, get out, but maybe he will be okay. It is brutal, but it's also difficult to tell what's going to happen to you, and I just think it's really hard when you're in your 20s and 30s to say you're going to have these possible serious effects when you're 50 and 60, and when you're in your 20s and 30s, you say, well, hell with it. I don't even plan to live past 40. What do I care? And then you're right. There are other factors like two marriages and breakups. That stuff takes away a lot of your money, and you need money, and he's a boxer. So there's a lot that goes into and it's hard to quit the sports when that's who you are and how you identify yourself.
Yeah, and I think he fought 676 rounds in 81 fights, and even in that sixth round against Ron Kramer in 1992, the man still wouldn't quit, you know. And I remember reading, you know, that his dad had written that, you know, basically beat into them that a quarry never quits. And
he definitely wasn't a quitter. He was definitely a guy who wanted to keep going, and I think the referees, for the most part, you know, except for maybe Joe Louis, they usually did stop these fights when they had to be stopped, and I don't think they gave him such an excessive beating unnecessarily, like we were talking about Pinglin Thomas a while ago, and I thought, God, I got to stop some of these fights. They usually did stop the Corey fights when they needed to be stopped.
Yeah, and I was wrong. It was his brother Mike that fought 600-some rounds. Jerry fought 419 rounds. Bobby, who got knocked out by Tommy Morrison, also had a multitude of problems. So that also plays into the thing where I think heredity has a little bit to do with the brain. I think you could be predisposed from it. And just the fact that you got the Benitez brothers, you got the Quarry brothers, I think kind of reinforces that case also.
Also, and I think one thing that's really important is we only get to see, you know, what happens on the football field or in the boxing ring. But what they've certainly learned in football, and hopefully they learn in boxing too, is to not make the training so harsh. There's no reason to take so many punches, you know, training for a fight. And football practices used to be all full scrimmage. Now they really take it easy until game day. And I hope with boxing, they train these guys, but there's no reason to take a lot of punches to the head before the fight.
Yeah, but see, the thing I noticed was this. From watching all this film on Corey, there's a lot of film of him sparring. 90% of that film of him sparring, there's no headgear.
Yeah, that's extraordinary now. I mean, I guess, you know, the thing is, and he's a victim of this too, and the football player's a victim of this, they really didn't talk about concussion injury, you know, and stuff like that until really just the last 10 years. So at least now young people have a choice, or at least have a better awareness at a time. Now, you know, always knew boxers could get hurt, but I just don't think it was so much a discussion as it is in the last decade.
Yeah, it was more of in 1978, if you got hit and knocked out, well, I got dinged.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, the way sometimes I'm sort of glad when we sort of do these stuff, because we're trying to remember these boxers. It's kind of easy to kind of move on to the next fight, move on to the next game, move on to the next, you know, a lot of these football players, they're sort of forgotten after their careers are over. Well, I think boxing fans, we really still love our fighters, even long after they're retired. But yeah, hopefully there is more concern in the training rounds of using headgear. There's really no reason not to wear headgear while you're training.
And I think Jerry Quarry's famous quote that he was always the bridesmaid, never the bride. But I think if you put Jerry Quarry in almost any other era, especially today, Jerry Quarry, I don't care how big Joshua and Wilder are, Jerry Quarry with his counterpunching, his head movement, and his toughness would beat the hell out of everybody fighting today.
Yeah, I can't tell you that, but I can tell you that he was at the particular time, at his peak, he had not only Jimmy Ellis, but certainly Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, and George Foreman right on their heels, and those are just three of the great ones, and it's just really hard. If, you know, it's just kind of what era you're in, and he was in an era with three of the best.
Yeah, if you put Jerry Quarry of 1967 in 1955 or 56, he's the heavyweight champion of the world.
That I can't tell you. I can't tell you, though, he's an excellent, both a boxer and a slugger. Usually one tends to be one or the other, but I think he could be described as a boxer slugger.
Well, put it like this. Guys like Jack Sharkey, James Braddock, you know,
yeah,
we're all heavyweight champions of the world.
Right, I agree.
Leon
It's
Spence.
Your era. And that,
I mean,
he would have done very well.
Yeah.
He would have done very well if put into a different era. He would have a champ. He would be considered a heavyweight champion. Probably not one of the best heavyweight champions, but he would be a heavyweight champion if he fought in the early 30s.
All right, Christopher, we're going to go ahead and wrap the show up for this week. I want to remind everybody, you can check out the show we did a couple weeks ago on Tommy Morrison against George Foreman. Soon to be released, we'll have the career of Riddick Bowe. We also did a show on Tyson Holyfield. We did a couple other ones, too, but I don't remember that well.
Jack Johnson, I remember.
Okay. Yeah, we did Johnson and Jeffries, was it?
Yep. Yeah, it was a fun one. I love that stuff.
Yeah, so check those out. Also, if you're listening live right now, you can come back here in an hour, and I will have former junior welterweight champion, Cool Vince Phillips, who pulled off one of the greatest upsets, I think, in boxing history, when he upset undefeated Kostyazoo in 1997. So come back here and check that out. Also, at 5 o'clock today, we'll have the Clam and Natural Health Show about New Year's resolutions. Tomorrow night, we will have, at 6 o'clock Eastern, our year-end boxing awards with myself, John Einreinhofer, Jeremiah Pricer, and John Raspani, who was the author of Intimate Warfare, the book about the Arturo Gatti, Mickey Ward, three-fight trilogy. Make sure you check that book out on Amazon. Also, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock Eastern, we will have a college football Final Four preview show on with myself, Brian Schmidt, and former Alabama offensive lineman, two-time national champion Bill Searcy, who played for Bear Bryant in 1979 and 1980. So make sure you check all that out. Remember, we are at Grueling Truth on Twitter. Follow us there. You can follow us on our Facebook group, also The Grueling Truth. You can hear all of our shows on iHeartRadio, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, Stitcher. Wherever you find sports podcasts, you'll find The Grueling Truth. So for Christopher Shelton, I'm Mike Goodpaster. You've been listening to The Grueling Truth, where the legends speak.
You can't control what's outside your home, but you can control what comes in. Because Clorox disinfecting wipes kill 99.9% of viruses and bacteria, including COVID-19 virus, when used as directed on hard, non-porous surfaces. So whether it's from dirty doorknobs, dirty shoes, or something else, outside germs won't stand a chance. When it counts, trust Clorox. Kill Pseudomonas, Salmonella, and Influenza virus type A2. Kill SARS-CoV-2 on hard, non-porous surfaces. Use as directed.
You don't need to understand how pre-collision cameras detect pedestrians in low light. You don't need to understand any of the craft that went into the Lexus ES to feel it. with outstanding connectivity and standard Lexus Safety System Plus 2.0. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer. Click the banner to discover more.
LSS Plus 2.0 and the pre-collision system with pedestrian detection are not a substitute for safe and attentive driving practices. See owner's manual for additional limitations and details.